Hello, Joel Dunning here with another CTS Net Beat. All the news in cardiac thoracic surgery every week brought straight to you. We've got loads of great articles. We've got the amazing new aortic guidelines for aortic arch surgery. Amazing from Dr. Cerny and many others. Lima to LAD, how to train in off pump. A brilliant interview with Anna Olds about the horrific things that happen to cardiac thoracic female surgeons. Emergency thoracotomy video and a septal myectomy video. We will also be introducing every week a topic. I'm going to call it full flow because we're going to get in full flow all about a topic. And this week I'm going to tell you all about guidelines, how we should fix them, what's wrong with guidelines, and a way forward to make them 100 times better. I've got a few thoughts on that I'll share with you in the full podcast, and I'd love to hear what you think about how we create guidelines and how we can make them better and more collaborative in the future. So tune into our full podcast with me, Joel Dunning. So thank you very much for tuning in. My name is Joel Dunning. We're here with the CTS Net Beat every single week, bringing you the best cardiac thoracic news every single week. And we've got loads of news for you. We always have three good articles, three great videos, sometimes a special mention and a few other things. But we're going to start something new every week, and we're going to talk about a topic that annoys me or is interested, that I'm interested in, or something that we should try and change the world about. And we're going to call this Full Flow, because we're going to get in full flow about this. And when I was reading the absolutely fantastic guideline by Martin Cerny and EACTS and the STS, and it's entitled Guidelines for Diagnosing and Treating Acute and Chronic Syndromes of the Aortic Organ, it got me thinking about guidelines. And so that's the topic we're going to talk about this week, because I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with guidelines. I've done quite a few guidelines. I actually started in Oxford at the Centre of Evidence-Based Medicine as a medical student. Professor Sackett was setting up this new thing, evidence-based medicine. I went to work for NICE as a full-time systematic reviewer for a year in London in the year 2000. It wasn't so easy then. Mainly, I had to be next to the library. I had to go to Index Medicus. I had to hand into the librarian every article that I wanted. I collected 200 articles, actually, and then documented them all one by one on my brand new computer. I had a laptop then, but now it's got so much easier, hasn't it? So we can sit at home doing our literature reviews, our meta-analyses, and working together on them. So I've now done 19 guidelines. We've done guidelines for EACTS, ESTS, Australian guidelines, and actually some with resus councils. And even I got a guideline accepted last week to EACTS, all about pectus. But guidelines can send you crazy. Guidelines can be terrible. Guidelines can be pointless. So why do we have so many guidelines? Well, at their best, like this brilliant one by Martin Cerny and the team, it informs. It tells you the current state of aortic surgery. It also pushes forwards the boundaries of what we're all doing. It informs us to be doing the same thing. And also, if you're interacting with other specialties, it helps you to say, well, we follow these guidelines. And as we'll talk about in a bit about these guidelines, you know, they push the boundaries. They're bringing the diameter of the aorta down to 52 millimeters from 55 for a standard person. And, you know, that's a real help to our listeners, our readers, the people that need these guidelines. But I've seen some horrific guidelines as well in the UK, NHS England, that governs what is done on the NHS, did a terrible, terrible guideline on pectus. It was shortcut. It was really done on the cheap by non-experts. They had a total non-expert panel. They only reviewed 6 papers and they took pectus surgery of all kinds off the NHS, making massive mistakes for the most severest of our patients who have cardiac compression. It's been a catastrophe. I've been involved in some guidelines for antiplatelet anticoagulation management. Didn't do anything. I don't think anyone read them. I don't think it was help. And I think the reason, say, the anticoagulation guidelines didn't work, because it wasn't a topic people were shouting out to have a guideline on. I think the NHS England was a disaster because it was cut price and it wasn't done properly. So here are my thoughts. Firstly, you've got to do them professionally. I also hate guidelines where you get an expert team together and you chop up the guidelines and you say to 7 experts, go and write the chapter, do the systematic reviewer's job. That's not a good idea. Get systematic reviewers to do the systematic reviews and get the experts to be experts. So I really, really think it's so important to make sure you've got experts on your team. When I was at university, I actually had a colleague called Viv Muthu who set up a private company doing the literary reviews. So there are really, really professional people doing these now. As of note, it costs about $50,000 to do a really good systematic review. And I'm so glad to see that the STS and EACs are working really well, doing really professional guidelines. And so that's the first thing I look at. Who did the systematic review and did they do it well? Because you just want to persuade us, your readers, that you've done a really, really good job. But number two is collaboration. And this is really the hub of my full flow this week. How can we advance the specialty of guideline development and writing? Because I was actually surprised to see this guideline. I didn't know it was coming out. I'm really quite interested in aortic surgery. I love seeing the developments in it. And yet I didn't know it was coming along. Whereas when I did guidelines for the RESUS Council, there is a big, massive international liaison committee on resuscitation. All the seven RESUS councils work together. But they, every 5 years, have a conference on nothing but their guidelines. You go from room to room where everybody is discussing every single minutiae of the guideline and everyone fills in the tent. They're publishing every single literature review they do. They've got 2 months for you to reply back. Loads of people are replying back. So when the guidelines come out in resuscitation, they're not a surprise. They're absolutely really, really known, really talked about, and everyone's involved. In fact, really interestingly, I was involved in the guidelines in the era when they took off atropine from the RESUS algorithm in arrest, and they were just about to take off epinephrine, adrenaline, and it was a big massive room. They said there's no evidence for it, let's get rid of epinephrine off an arrest guideline. And yet one person in the room put their hand up and said, you know, this is going to be a massive move for training, this is a huge departure, should we just pause and not do it? And the guidelines stopped. They didn't take off epinephrine off the guidelines, and that wouldn't have happened if that had been a small group of 12 people. So what I think should happen in guidelines these days is they should be much more prominent in our conferences. You know, why in the STS conference in San Antonio, why wasn't the rooms full of, we're creating this guideline, we're creating that guideline, come and collaborate with our guideline. We want to hear your views, because the more people that get involved in guidelines, the more we're going to feel we're part of it and we'll feel engaged. And when 52 millimeters comes out as the next criteria, you're going to go, well, I was in the room, or I was online watching that, or I did an input, I thought that was going a bit crazy, or that wasn't enough. So I think we need to be much more involved as a whole community. I would love to see guidelines at the hub of every conference, like a whole day or a whole sidearm of where you and I can walk in and contribute. And finally, the next bit that has to happen is we need feedback. We need feedback loops. What effect are our guidelines having? So what effect are our guidelines having? We don't know is the answer. We don't come back to conferences going, 2 years since the guideline, 90% of what we're recommending has been implemented. And yes, we could do. So we could use the STS database to see what the average diameter that is being operated on of the thoracic aorta. We could feed that back 2 years later. We could go, which elements of the guideline are being implemented, which aren't being implemented, and try and work on the reasons why that guideline isn't being implemented. So the two things I'd change is get guidelines into conferences, get everyone talking about them, get everyone inputting into them, and secondly, feedback. Let's all have databases and submit information on whether or not we're following the guidelines. And if we're not, let's, a few years later, change the guideline or work out why. The other thing is we don't tend to update them regularly enough, do we? I don't think so. So we should be having this feedback loop going. So, well, that's my full flow rant of the week. I'd be interested to hear what you think about guidelines. Do you just read them and go, yeah, not another of them? Or do you actually find them really, really useful in your practice? We should talk a little bit more about that guideline, shouldn't we? So just to let you know a bit more about it, it was a real star cast. Martin Cerny, Martin Gravenvolker, Tim Berger, just so many, John Eleftheriadis, and Carlos Mestres, you know, all the great and the good of aortic surgery, I think, were in this brilliant guideline. The other really great thing is STS EACs collaborating, and there are going to be lots more of those, which I'm really pleased to see. It was 79 pages. It was huge. It was fascinating. It was was really informative, and I think it is very, very practice changing. So they're trying to get us away from Stanford type A and Stanford type B for dissections. In fact, they were telling me about non-A, non-B dissections, which I didn't really appreciate as a new category. But they say, don't go down this road. Go down Ishimaru zones. Let's talk about zone 0 for ascending aorta, 1, 2, and 3 for the arch, and 4 for descending. There are actually 12 zones, and they've got a lovely picture of that. They said, let's not talk about MB. Let's do the TEM categorization. T type, E entry, where was the entry portion, and M, malperfusion, what's malperfused. This is a much more accurate way of deciding about dissections. So I really like. We actually, at CTSNet, got a bit of hot water recently because Craig Miller hated one of our videos that talked about hemiarch replacement. And in his view, it wasn't a hemiarch. And in this guideline, they very clearly set out what is a hemiarch. They say a hemiarch is replacing the ascending aorta and performing an open distal anastomosis, resecting the entire concavity of the arch down to the proximal descending aorta. So really good definitions. But here were the big ones. In patients with low surgical risk and an ascending phenotype dilatation with tricuspid or bicuspid valve, surgical treatment should be considered when the maximum aortic diameter is more than 52 millimeters, not 55. I thought that's fascinating. And the second one was in patients with tricuspid aortic valves with this same phenotype in a low surgical risk, consider resecting it at 50 millimeters. If any of these are present, age less than 50, a short patient, an ascending aortic length of more than 11 centimetres, or growth being quite fast or very hypertensive. So brand new for the first time ever, if the length of your dilated aorta is being considered as well. So what a great guideline. Really, really interesting. You can get it full text straight away by clicking on the links below. So the second paper we've got for you on CTSNet this week is a really good one as well from the European Heart Journal. David Messica-Tezun, Bernard Lung, chose a year in cardiovascular medicine, 2023, top 10 papers in valvular heart disease. So they didn't just flick themselves. They got a big committee together. They looked at all the best journals, JAMA, New England Heart Journal, Circulation, New England Journal, etc. And they chose the 10 based on a committee consensus. Interesting, most of them were on transcatheter techniques. So they chose partner 3 in low-risk patients. They chose the Nordic aortic valve intervention trial comparing SAVA and TAVI with the core valve, which had very good results. They chose a paper on transcatheter aortic valve replacement in shock, in cardiogenic shock, showing that actually it was quite a good idea. They did a paper on how you treat paravalvular aortic regurgitation after TAVI, which was quite interesting. In the surgical space, they chose a really good paper on the impact of patient prosthesis mismatch by Dismore et al. And showed that moderate mismatch is not too bad, but severe is terrible. I like that. They showed the great paper by Vinay Badwar et al., the STS database, showing that the mortality of mitral repair is less than 1% these days. And they did a few other. They did a few transcatheter repairs for tricuspid regurg, which I thought was really good, and the TriScore. And they looked at the PROACT 10A trial, trying to see if we could use NOACs for mechanical aortic valve replacements, which I feel so sad about because, unfortunately, thromboembolic rate was 4% versus 1%. If you were using a apixaban versus standard warfarin for a mechanical aortic valve, what a shame. But the bleeding rate was less, which means maybe they were aiming a bit too thin, I thought. Anyway, really good 10 papers as a quick update of what's great and good in 2023. And hang on for my special mention right at the end. We're going to tell you a little bit more about tricuspid valve intervention. And the third paper we have this week is by Shihito Nato and Bjorn Still from Hamburg in Germany in the Thoracic and Aortic Vascular Surgeon this week. And it was all on single lima to LAD is it the perfect tool for OPCAB training? And they basically took 180 patients and they compared the operation if an experienced surgeon did it versus a new person doing off-pump surgery for the first time. And basically they said the patients didn't suffer at all, so it was a great idea. So nice paper, check that out if you're wanting to learn off-pump surgery. So I'm briefly going to just jump to the team in the CTSNet office and they're going to tell you what else you can find on the website this week.
Are you on the lookout for a new job in cardiothoracic surgery? Hundreds of open positions are waiting for you at CTSNet's Career Center. Through ctsnet.org, you can browse jobs and sign up for custom job alerts direct to your inbox. For an even more enhanced experience, create a free account and upload your resume so employers and recruiters can find you.
We've got three great videos for you on the website. The first one's by Anna Olds, interviewed by Mara Antonoff, again from the STS, where we went in San Antonio. And really a shocking account of family planning and pregnancy complications in female cardiothoracic surgeons. I mean, just horrific. The 50% of female cardiothoracic surgeons report a miscarriage or problem with getting pregnant, as opposed to about 20% in the general population. 70% had no time off when they had a miscarriage. There's just some terrible, terrible figures here, really. And luckily, they do discuss what the STS is going to do about it. So I think really brave, really great work that they're doing at the moment on trying to level the playing fields for male and female cardiothoracic surgeons in our specialty. The second video we've got for you is an emergency anterior bilateral thoracotomy by Claudia Villanueva. This is an illustration and has also got some nice graphics on how you might perform an emergency clamshell. So it's quite nice. So go there if you would like to check that out. In fact, we've got a whole emergency thoracotomy course that we run in the UK. We actually use a video that I've got on Vimeo as a real video that was taken in an Australian emergency department where somebody arrested while a whole film crew was there filming a cardiothoracic surgeon. And they performed a brilliant clamshell, saved this guy's life, and the guy's around today. And we actually teach with pig heart lung blocks. We go down to A&Es and teach emergency physicians. It's amazing what they don't know and amazing what a help it is to go down and join in with your emergency physician colleagues to do training, especially if they don't do emergency clamshell thoracotomies very often. In fact, that's going to be a guideline probably next year that we are working on in the UK. Reach out to me if you want to see more about emergency thoracotomy as well, or want to even start a course where you are. And the third video we have for you, not wanting to forget the pediatric surgeons out there, is a lovely video on subaortic membrane resection and septal myectomy. This is a great video from the Magdi Yacoub Centre in Aswan, and it's really, really nice. Amir Al-Zakawi and Hatem Hosni, amongst others, did this great video on a 9-year-old that had a ventricular outflow obstruction. They really nicely show us the video. They do a great big incision of the myectomy, which is really nicely captured on their video, and really, really great. So I was very, very pleased to see that submitted. What's going on in the world this week and in the next few weeks? Well, we're very pleased to be bringing with CTSNet and the ASAIO webinar, a joint webinar, and the title of it is Donor Heart Preservation and Resuscitating Marginal Donors, Hot or Cold. This will be on March the 14th on Thursday, March the 14th at 2 p.m. Central Time, it's going to be free. So do join in. Mark Slaughter, Adam Protoss, Ashok Kumar are going to be hosting. It's all about resuscitating marginal donors, an expert panel, and DCD donors' heart preservation. So I think it'll be really great. It's free, and it's in collaboration with CTSNet, which we're really pleased to do another of our collaborations with this excellent group. So honourable mention, I just want to give an honourable mention to the new Edwards Evoque tricuspid valve replacement. A lot of us were surprised that the FDA have just given approval in February 2024 for this to be approved in America. So, and yet it's It's only had one randomized trial. It's only had a couple of hundred patients. It hasn't even reported the trial yet. And yet the data does look promising. The safety is outstanding. The efficacy seems to be really good for patients with severe tricuspid regurgitation and really bad symptoms, not suitable for surgery. So it's a cool valve. It's a replacement. It sort of locks itself into the papillary muscles of the tricuspid valve. It's done via a transcatheter technique. Obviously, it's from the venous side, even safer. So yeah, this looks like a really, really great future for this valve. So congratulations to getting in so quickly. I think we all expected there to be a panel convened, a lot more thought of the evidence, but in this case, the FDA have gone like rockets to get this out really soon. And finally, where is Diego? I like to check in every now and again to the roving world training thoracic surgeon that is Diego Gonzalez Rivas. And this week he has been in Tanzania doing the country's first unipolar VATS. And he did a left pneumonectomy and he did a thymectomy, first time in Tanzania. So congratulations to Diego. So that's everything we've got this week. We're going to try and carry on doing a full flow topic every single week. Suggest a topic of the week if you like. Otherwise, I'm just going to take it from whatever seems topical in the news. So, hope you've enjoyed this episode and do join us again next week for the CTSNet Beat podcast.